Isabel Allende at the America Society Council of the Americas here in New York earlier this year. On November 24th, President Obama awarded her the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Isabel Allende is the author of 20 books, including The House of the Spirits, Paola, Daughter of Fortune. Her latest is the mystery novel based in the Bay Area titled Ripper. Her books have been translated into 35 languages, have sold close to 60 million copies around the world. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to watch all of our interviews with Isabel Allende. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Daniel Begun, Anna Uzbek, and Sam Riddell. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, David Prude, and Vesta Gadars. And our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Craig-Meadows, Carla DeJesus, and Phil Raymond. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website, democracynow.org.
It is now 5 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the daily headlines in the news from Counterspin. And followed is going to be at 6 p.m. Bread and Roses. So stick around. Happy Friday, everyone. Again, this is KBOO, your community radio station.
KBOO at the Clinton, a monthly film screening at the Clinton Street Theater, is proud to show Five Broken Cameras on Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. The first ever Palestinian film to be nominated for Best Documentary Feature, Five Broken Cameras is a deeply personal first-hand account of life and nonviolent resistance in a West Bank village surrounded by Israeli settlements. Shot by Palestinian farmer Ahmad Burnat, who brought his first camera in 2005 to record the birth of his youngest son, the film is structured in chapters around the destruction of each one of Burnat's cameras. Again, that's Five Broken Cameras, Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Be a part of Giving Tuesday on December 2nd, a day that inspires personal philanthropy and encourages bigger, better, and smarter charitable giving during the holiday season. KBOO is excited to participate, and we have a $5,000 match for the month of December. All new memberships and additional donations made by current members will be matched. If you gave $60 last year and decide to give $100, it will be matched for the $40 increase. If you give monthly and give an additional one-time gift, that amount will be matched. Go to kboo.fm/give to make your donation now. And thank you to the Juan Young Trust, Vernier Software, SSI Shredding Systems, and the Wendy Foundation for empowering KBOO with their matching contributions. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, Barack Obama's executive action on immigration has right-wing Republicans calling for impeachment, or at least censure, or at least defunding of any agencies involved in implementing it. So does that mean it's good? We'll hear from media maker and organizer Megan Ortiz on what media's overwhelmingly inside the beltway framing leaves out. Also this week, fracking is often portrayed in the corporate media as many steps in the right direction. Energy independence, job creation, not to mention homeowners striking it rich. But a new investigation in These Times magazine shows that poverty and drilling go hand in hand. We'll talk to journalist Hannah Guzik about environmental racism and the fight to find out the public health risks associated with fracking. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
As the country awaited the grand jury announcement from Ferguson, Missouri, some media outlets decided the time could be filled with anonymous speculation about the threat posed by violent protesters. That's the angle CBS News went with on November 21st. The news was that two men, said to be affiliated with the New Black Panther Party, had been arrested for an illegal gun purchase. But CBS decided to add a more menacing layer to the story. Citing a law enforcement source, CBS reported that the suspects had allegedly purchased explosive materials to use in pipe bombs. The CBS report was picked up by other outlets, including NBC's Today Show. But the inflammatory anonymous tip vanished pretty quickly. The stories on the CBS website switched from explosives and pipe bombs to the original two firearm purchases. There is a long history of media floating anonymous warnings about the dangers posed by protesters, back to unfounded claims of widespread arson in the 1999 Seattle WTO protests, to an array of claims about what protesters were planning to do at the Republican National Convention in 2004. These stories have little basis in fact, but they serve a purpose to justify harsh crackdowns on largely peaceful protest movements.
Supporters of Officer Darren Wilson have always claimed that part of what justified his shooting and killing Michael Brown was the fact that he had been seriously wounded in a confrontation with the unarmed teenager. Some right-wing outlets went so far as to claim Wilson suffered a fractured eye socket. But it wasn't just right-wing media. Back on an August 20th broadcast of ABC World News, here's what anchor Diane Sawyer told viewers.
Tonight we are hearing from a source close to the police officer who shot Brown. And this source says the policeman's face was seriously injured. And the source says that could change this case.
Correspondent Jim Avila said there was new information.
A hospital picture of Officer Wilson's face not yet released. A source close to Wilson says the officer suffered a serious facial injury during the initial struggle at the patrol car window.
So ABC's report was apparently based on what a friend of Wilson said could be seen in a hospital photo. When the grand jury released photos of Wilson taken right after he shot Michael Brown, there was no serious facial injury to be seen. One recurring theme in the coverage of Ferguson has been how the social media activism that drew corporate media attention to the killing of Michael Brown was full of conspiracy theories and rumor mongering. So, will ABC now tell viewers that it spread an unfounded rumor that there was photographic evidence that Darren Wilson was seriously hurt? Or is accountability just not part of their world?
Last week, we talked about how coverage of the Keystone XL pipeline was falling short, misleading viewers about thousands of jobs created and so-called energy independence. Unfortunately, things aren't getting much better. On the November 23rd episode of Meet the Press, Chuck Todd wanted to use Keystone to talk more broadly about energy policy. His starting point was to belittle the issue. He told viewers that this is largely a symbolic fight because, quote, Canadian tar sands oil is already getting to refineries in the U.S. by barge and train, close quote. Huh, so a massive corporation is investing billions of dollars to build a symbol? That would be odd. In reality, Keystone is designed to transport much more oil to U.S. refineries than can be shipped via rail. That is one reason people oppose Keystone. It represents, in very real terms, a decision to burn millions of tons of carbon when we should be doing the very opposite. But if your starting point is that Keystone doesn't really matter, the discussion that flows from that is probably going to be pretty narrow. And sure enough, it was. Todd's guests were energy analyst Daniel Yergin, he advises oil companies, and the former CEO of Shell. Unsurprisingly, they largely agreed. Last week, Meet the Press had two pro-Keystone pundits. This week, not much better.
The 2010 explosion at the Upper Big Branch coal mine in West Virginia killed 29 of the 31 men at the site, the deadliest mine accident in 40 years. Don Blankenship, the notorious CEO of mine owner Massey Energy, just pled not guilty to conspiracy and other charges. He's accused of ignoring safety and health regulations for the sake of profit and of lying to investigators about safety practices. It's significant to see an executive actually face charges for actions leading to deaths in the workplace. The trouble is, many people aren't seeing it at all. Apart from the Associated Press, the story of Blankenship's court case is getting next to no play in major media. That may have something to do with the judge in the case, Irene Berger's, issuance of an incredibly sweeping gag order, prohibiting anyone associated with the case, directly or indirectly, from making any statements of any nature in any form or releasing any documents to the media or anyone else. She also declared that only case participants will have access to documents, with the public's access restricted to lists of filings. You'd think that reporters would respond with outrage to such a move, but there's little evidence of that. The Los Angeles Times stands pretty much alone in making an effort, including comments of a relative of one of the men killed, who spoke to reporters despite the judge's order. Perhaps things will change as Blankenship's case goes to trial. The U.S. public deserves to learn about this rare instance of a powerful corporate executive being held to account. And finally, remember Benghazi? The 2012 attack on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Libya dominated headlines and cable news shows for a long time. It was the single most talked-about international policy issue in the 2012 presidential debates. Now, a two-year investigation by the Republican-controlled House Intelligence Committee has concluded that the CIA and the military acted properly in responding to the attack. Though there was some miscommunication by intelligence analysts in the immediate aftermath, the investigation determined there was, quote, no intelligence failure, no delay in sending a CIA rescue team, no missed opportunity for a military rescue, and no evidence the CIA was covertly shipping arms from Libya to Syria, close quote. That quote is from the AP story on the report, which described it as, quote, debunking a series of persistent allegations hinting at dark conspiracies, close quote. No one loved those conspiracies more than the Fox News Channel. One of the network's regulars said that Hillary Clinton herself killed those Americans. So, you might wonder, how is Fox News handling the committee's new findings? The website Daily Kos looked into it and found what you'd expect. Fox devoted less than 30 seconds, concentrated on the initial miscommunication about the attack's origins, without noting that it came from intelligence analysts, not Susan Rice or Hillary Clinton. The network's online article had the head-scratching headline, CIA Gathered Intelligence on Weapons to Syria, Benghazi Report, and led with the fact that right-wing Senator Lindsey Graham wants to expand the investigation. The main findings, as reported matter-of-factly by AP, NPR, CNN, even the Wall Street Journal, were nowhere to be found. As the Daily Kos put it, it's not news, it's Fox News. Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. To hear big media tell it, the debate about Barack Obama's executive action on immigration is between immigrants and their advocates, described by ABC News as ecstatic, and right-wing Republicans who think Obama overstepped his authority. The action will temporarily shield from deportation and give work permits to undocumented immigrants who are parents of U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents and have been in the country for more than 5 years. If they pass criminal background checks, submit fingerprints, and pay a more than $400 application fee. Obama says it makes the system more fair and more just. The New York Times calls it wise. What questions aren't we hearing, though, about this new plan? Joining us now is Megan Ortiz, media maker and organizer based in Los Angeles. She joins us by phone from Los Angeles. Welcome back to Counterspin, Megan Ortiz.
Thank you, Janine. Always a pleasure to be on with you.
Well, Meet the Press talked to a woman who said, I can go to college now. And another woman who said, my mom can come out of the shadows. It certainly sounds good. And for some people, seeing Republicans get so livid over it means it must be good. But are immigrants and their advocates overwhelmingly ecstatic, as ABC had it? What's missing from that storyline?
What's missing, Janine, and I think what's consistently been missing in the mainstream media and also in the Spanish language media, honestly, has been the nuance, right? The fact that, for example, the executive action that was announced last week talks about yes, families being able to, quote unquote, come out of the shadows sort of denies the fact that estimates put about 11 million undocumented families and individuals in the United States. This plan will affect possibly up to 5 million people. And it's important to note the word possibly because the applications haven't actually started yet. There is certain eligibilities that need to be met, including being able to pass a background check, paying a fee, something that is really inaccessible also to lots of immigrant community members across the United States. I think also the family narrative is a little bit concerning. It plays into what has been this constant narrative of good immigrant versus bad immigrant. Families are good immigrants. In fact, one of the taglines that came out when the announcement was made was, families, yes, felons, no. As if felons do not have families or are not part of family units. I specifically here in Los Angeles work with lots of undocumented day laborers and domestic workers who, because of the fact of their migration, would not be considered quote-unquote family because they don't have children here in the United States. So yesterday, for example, at a meeting, we actually had some of those family members crying because they are going to be left out of this process. I think another thing that's not being talked about is that this five-year number that's being thrown out for the new Deferred Actions for Parents program, DAPA, is that, A, it's temporary, and B, along with it came a very firm announcement from Obama that people who have come in within the last 5 years who didn't make the cutoff would be priorities for deportation. So we're not talking about a lessening of the deportation machine. We're not talking about a lessening of this 400,000 people a year who are being detained and deported in the United States.
One thing that I've heard noted is that this idea of a criminal record, it's been pointed out that that would include fraud, which is likely to be something you can charge a lot of folks who have been working without documentation or are here without documentation or are guilty of fraud. You know, so this idea of crimes, people may think it's we're talking about murderers, but it seems like the devil's in the details on that one.
Right. And I think another thing that people need to look at is let's look at the historical record of the Obama administration on that very specific issue. A few years back, when Morton was the head of ICE, you know, there was this memo that came out on prosecutorial discretion that said, yes, only people with certain criminal records or criminal backgrounds should be priorities for deportation. And yet all records indicate and all numbers indicate that that memo was never originally followed. So in many ways, this new executive action is a repetition of the same memo, which was never followed in the first place.
The New York Times noted as encouraging, with caveats, that the action is going to end the so-called Secure Communities program, which the Times called blighted, and others would certainly agree. But what's really going on there with Secure Communities?
Well, what's really interesting about the quote-unquote ending of Secure Communities is that it's not actually ending. It's sort of a rebranding, which is something we've seen the Obama administration do many times with different immigration policy. So while SCOM, Secure Communities, as a name will end, it's going to be replaced by a new program called the PEP program. But the thing is that pretty much people's biometric information, for example, as soon as they enter into the criminal justice system, is still going to be taken. Fingerprints are still going to be taken and sent to ICE. We've already seen that prosecutorial discretion has not been followed inside the detention centers. Now the request is that people aren't detained, but that ICE will be informed when an undocumented immigrant is released. So there's no guarantee that ICE still won't pick these people up and send them into detention or deportation. And along the same lines, Janine, when we talk about, you know, detention and deportation, I think we need to note that while Obama is talking about this program to keep people here and keep people out of the shadows, the concern is that because this is only a temporary measure, are we asking undocumented immigrants to come out of the shadows and basically report to deport at some time in the future? What's going to happen to all these people who submit their biometric information and are not accepted to the program or are accepted and the next president does not continue with the program? That's a very huge concern as well.
Well, there's something just grotesque as I've also heard a friend note about Obama telling Hondurans, for example, to get right with the law after the U.S. supported the 2009 coup in there that led to such poverty and bloodshed, and it's a reason that so many, particularly unaccompanied minors, are coming from Honduras into the United States. It sticks in the craw. I wonder also, are we really looking at the reasons that people come? I mean, it seems to me that's still kind of being overlooked, at least in the media story.
Absolutely. I mean, and if you look at the case of the unaccompanied minors and people coming from Central America, most of that migration is due in part to U.S. foreign policy and U.S. economic policy as well. So it's not just about the violence that the United States has helped to create in Latin America. It's also about the economic violence through free trade agreements like NAFTA, through the whole maquiladora system. We think about these most recent young people and young women who have been coming from Central America. Most of these people could possibly be on the fast track to deportation because of this new immigration action. So I think, you know, there's been lots of talk about what does state violence look like. You know, we think about what happened in Mexico and Ayotzinapa. We think about what just happened in Ferguson. State violence manifests itself in many ways. And unfortunately, the fear is that this new executive action is also going to pave the way for a new form of state violence in the form of more people being deported if they don't fit certain criteria.
You said that even Spanish language media is not necessarily fulfilling the role of providing the kind of alternative or nuance that you might expect on this issue.
They really aren't. So Spanish language media, specifically Univision, who I've been following, they're really crying victory over this. Like, this is going to be the answer for everything. Again, not really explaining the nuance of it. And we're even seeing Spanish language media sort of repeating the talking points coming from the Obama administration, like getting right with the law, getting to the back of the line. Even this line of immigrants will now have to pay their fair share of taxes sort of goes against a number of reports that have come out throughout the year showing that overall, undocumented immigrants have been paying way more into the system than they're able to take out of it. So it's very interesting to see that the Spanish language media, who usually is harsher and has a more critical look at immigration policies, in this case, there's really been more of a sense that they're just crying overall victory and not really looking at who's being left out and pushing for something more.
We've been speaking with Megan Ortiz. You can find her on Twitter at Mamita Mala. Thank you very much, Megan Ortiz, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
The U.S. domestic energy boom is often framed around opportunities like energy independence and weaning ourselves off foreign oil. Natural gas fracking is a job creator, breathing life back into hard-hit regions of the country. Best of all, fracking might make you rich. A 2012 ABC World News report cheered the prospect of finding oil right in your own backyard. These are pots of gold creating overnight millionaires. But a new report casts all of this in a very different light, looking at how oil and gas fracking affects the people living near the boom, people who are not, it turns out, striking it rich. Hannah Guzik is a journalist who writes about health and the environment. Her piece, Fracking the Poor, is in the December issue of In These Times magazine. Hannah, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter.
Now, you started looking at this in part because it was close to home. What is the story you wanted to tell about how oil and fracking in Central California looks up close that people might not be aware of?
Well, I became concerned about this because I live in one of these hot spots, so to speak. There's three big areas in California where fracking is going on. We have Ventura County, where I live, and then Los Angeles County. And then the big area is Kern County and the whole Central Valley included. And I had heard from some folks at a community meeting that there was a fracking fluid dumping site in Oxnard, which is a poor working class community in Ventura County, mostly Latino, and that the strawberry workers in the field surrounding the dumping site. It's called an injection well. We're concerned that it was making them sick or not feel well. They would hear these trucks rumble up, drop something off, and then a strange smell would drift over the field. And they were concerned, but they didn't really know what was going on. They didn't have any answers. And since this was in my community's backyard and where I am raising my daughter, where my family lives, I wanted to know as well. And so as a journalist, I started looking into this and found that it looked like these fracking operations were occurring in these pockets that were mostly low income, were people of color. There are significantly more poor people and people of color surrounding oil and gas wells. We found that nearly 20% of California residents who are poor live within a mile of a well. And so since this is such a populous state, that's 700,000 people. And 69% of people living within a mile of a well are also people of color. These are the folks who are most vulnerable, who have the most to lose from these environmental pollutants.
So the piece kind of maps income disparity, poverty, and where this drilling is going on. And one of the things I found striking about it was that there's so much complexity here. You have communities that are reliant on the jobs that these industries can bring in, so much so that people were showing up to protest a movie critical of fracking.
Right. These communities do rely on the money that fracking and oil production brings in, because there's not too much else going on in some of these areas. And they bring in millions of dollars every year in terms of jobs, in terms of taxes to the community. These are people who have grown up with oil, as they say, in their blood. Their fathers and in some cases grandfathers worked in fracking fields and oil fields. The thing I think that many people want is just information about what is occurring in their backyards.
And you note in the piece that there's opposition to fracking around the country, of course, but there is a class dynamic that places where they have been able to mobilize local opposition tend to be wealthier. So there is a very fascinating class dynamic to all of this.
Right. The research we've done showed that the places that have been able to put up moratoriums or bans on fracking or restrictions have largely been wealthier communities. It ends up being places like Beverly Hills in California versus some of the communities I wrote about in Kern County are quite poor and have more people who don't have the resources or the time off work to go to these community meetings and find out what's going on and organize themselves to stop the oil and gas developments from coming into their neighborhoods.
There are, of course, some exceptions to this. As you mentioned in the piece, the city of Compton, a low-income area in Southern California, actually passed a moratorium on fracking. I wanted to ask you about the big picture. One goal of any effort like this is, at the very least, transparency. As one of the experts that you cited in the piece put it, what chemicals are you using across the street from someone's house? What stands in the way of knowing even that much about how fracking is policing itself or how it's being regulated? Why can't we know something as seemingly as basic as what chemicals are you putting in the water?
Well, there are just so many protections and so few regulations on the books, both nationally and in most states, that sort of give oil and gas companies a pass on things like an environmental impact report, which nearly any other industry has to go through to do any sort of project. So there's this has just been going on for a long time in California. Fracking has been happening for more than six decades, since the 1950s. And we are just starting to kind of find out about it and find out where this is happening. And just for so long, it has been very loosely regulated or unregulated, whether that was from lawmakers being cozy with the industry or from just maybe negligence or thinking that it wasn't important. People can weigh in on all sides of that, but it just is concerning that the more we find out, the more concern there is and the more we realize how much we don't know.
We've been speaking with journalist Hannah Guzik. To read her piece, Fracking the Poor, go to the In These Times website at inthesetimes.com. Hannah Guzik, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. That's fair.org. While you're there, you can support us if you're so inclined. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
FSRN, the Weekly Edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on today's show, people in Ferguson and cities across the U.S. react to the grand jury decision not to indict a police officer who gunned down an unarmed African-American teenager.
Wilson, walking free. This is a rubber stamp on Michael Brown's murder. It's a rubber stamp on the murder of all Black and Latino youth.
Native